Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last night was the first and only vice presidential debate between Kamala Harris and Mike Pence. USA Today's Susan Page moderated the debate at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. COVID-19 was the first issue. According to Politico, at least 34 people connected to Donald Trump, including more than 18 White House officials, have now tested positive for the virus. 9 months into this crisis, cases are rising in 39 states. Over 212,000 people in the United States have died. Kamala Harris called the Trump administration's response, which has been led by Mike Pence, the greatest presidential failure in U.S. history. The candidates also discussed the economy, healthcare, U.S. foreign policy, the Supreme Court, and the climate crisis. Mike Pence ignored the rules many times by talking over his speaking limits, but at the end of the day, they both spoke for the same amount of time. He also lied about greenhouse gas emissions coming down under Trump and several of Joe Biden's plans. Both candidates refused to answer questions with direct answers by changing the subject. So today we want to talk about actual issues. The choices could not be starker. What stood out for you in last night's debate? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Today we are joined by Dave Leventhal, senior Washington correspondent for Business Insider, where he reports on politics, policy, and power in the nation's capital. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Good to be back with you.
Great to have you. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent with The Nation and author of many books, including his latest, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. It's a great book, and we had John on a couple of months ago to talk about it. Hi, John. Welcome back.
Hi. It's a great pleasure to be with both of you.
Well, it's great to have both of you, and you both sound good. We really want to talk about the issues today, but I do want to ask you both overall what your reaction was. Dave, let's start with you. What was your general reaction?
I think what we got was what most people expected. Number one, that it was going to be a much toned down version of a debate to compare to what we had just almost a week ago with Donald Trump and Joe Biden in the first presidential debate, which was, for all intents and purposes, in no way, shape, or form, a debate. This vice presidential debate was a debate. It was a debate that a lot of the questions that were answered or asked by moderator Susan Page were not answered by either of the candidates. And so in that regard, I think a lot of people were left wanting, and that a lot of the questions that perhaps you hoped were going to have a sharper answer, ultimately got turned into talking points for both the candidates. But bottom line is that vice presidential debates are not supposed to be the main event. They're not often very memorable. I mean, who really remembers the 2004 John Edwards Dick Cheney vice presidential debate, or for that matter, the Joe Biden-Paul Ryan debate of 2012. It's the presidential candidates that get the starring role, and for good reason.
What about you, John? What would you add?
Well, I thought that it was a very significant debate. David and I may differ. I have such respect for him, so I'm always cautious about this, but we may differ a little bit. I think vice presidential debates are almost always very important. They usually give an opportunity to clean up the messes that presidential candidates make. And in this case, that was Mike Pence's job. He desperately needed to turn in a stellar performance, one that was surprising, frankly, that would have really impressed folks, because Donald Trump's performance in the last debate was such a chaotic mess. And Pence actually did reasonably well. He's a skilled performer, former talk radio host, a longtime politician. He's debated often, and he pulled out a lot of his old tricks, did many of the things he's done in the past. He speaks very calmly, but then slides in zingers, if you will, with the goal of sort of derailing his opponent, forcing his opponent to come on to the territory he wants to debate. He did a lot of that last night, but it didn't work. And the reason it didn't work was because Kamala Harris is a skilled prosecutor, maybe not quite as experienced in the talk radio realm or the traditional political debate realm, but very, very competent when it comes to making a case and sticking to it. And the fact is that, Harris won the debate in the first 10, 12 minutes with her presentation on COVID-19, the pandemic, and the economic play out of it. Pence was standing behind a plexiglass screen trying to tell folks that everything was going great and that the administration had had a great success in taking on COVID-19. And it just, it was comic. It was almost absurd. And Harris was ready for that. And at almost every turn, no matter what Pence tried to throw at her, Harris went back to a set of core themes that really left, you know, left Pence with very little to stand on. So it was, I was surprised at what a clear victory it was for Harris. And frankly, I think it did quite a bit of damage to the Trump-Pence reelection run.
Well, let's talk about COVID, because that was the issue that was brought up first. Over 212,000 people in the United States have died from this virus 9 months into the crisis. Cases are rising in 39 states. And last night I was reading about Adeline Fagan. This is out of The Guardian. She tested positive in early July. She died in September. She is a U.S. health worker. She was only 28 years old, and her family said she wore the same mask for weeks, if not months. I was hoping that they would spend some more time talking about PPE last night, because I got an email from a nurse who works in the area. We've been emailing over the last 6 or so months, and she wants to remain anonymous. And she said they still do not have enough PPE. In fact, hospital workers went on strike in the East Bay yesterday over this issue. Overall, Dave, what were your thoughts about the questioning and the response, especially from Mike Pence? I mean, he led the White House COVID task force.
He sure did. And the last thing that President Trump really wants to talk about, and the last thing that Vice President Pence wants to talk about, is COVID-19. But they have to. They have no choice. The President of the United States contracted COVID-19. There are now dozens of people in the White House and in Donald Trump's inner circle who also now have been infected by it, and we're less than a month away from the election. So as much as they would like to talk about jobs, as much as they would like to talk about the economy, as much as they would like to talk about law and order, COVID-19 is front and center, and it's not a winning issue for them, no matter how you cut it. And you have, you know, let's step back a couple of days before the debate, when Donald Trump left Walter Reed Hospital, came back to the White House, and basically told all Americans that you shouldn't have to fear COVID-19, that you can't fear the coronavirus, and that he's living proof that there's a way to get beyond it. Well, in a way, I mean, it was as if the president was talking from some alternate universe. I mean, he has his own wing of a hospital at the ready for him. He has his own team of doctors. He has access to any drug or any therapy that you could possibly ever want, and then some. And then you have people all across the country who are on the opposite end of the spectrum, including some of the folks in the medical world that you just described, who quite literally can't get the most basic protective equipment in order to do their jobs and save lives. So to say that this is a tale of two Americas is it's about as colossal an understatement as you possibly could make in terms of the response. And, you know, some of that definitely was brought up in the debate, but I talked to a lot of people last night texting back and forth, sources who said that you could have spent the whole debate just talking about COVID-19 and the administration's response to it. This is something that you're going to hear literally hour by hour, minute by minute from the Biden campaign. They want to make as big an issue about this as they possibly can, and expect that they will from now until Election Day.
Well, as you were talking, I just got a press release from the California Nurses Association. Registered nurses at Alameda Hospital in Alameda and San Leandro Hospital in San Leandro remain on strike today. They are going to continue a five-day strike. They say that they have so many concerns over patient safety during the COVID pandemic, lots of issues with management, but they also say that they still lack PPE. John, I was glad that Susan Page said the U.S. death toll is higher than that of almost every other wealthy nation on Earth. She said, for instance, our death rate is 2.5 times that of Canada next door. And, you know, she said, can you explain this? And of course he didn't. But I think it was important for her to bring up that fact for those who might not know that.
Right. It was, I mean, this is the reason we have debates, right? It's to put the candidates into a setting that rises above the day-to-day spin of the campaign, the day-to-day, you know, paid and free media messaging that campaigns engage in, and to force candidates to deal with the realities as laid out by an able moderator. And sometimes you get that, sometimes you don't. But in this case, certainly in that initial round of questioning on COVID, and we could talk later about the rest of the debate where I think it did kind of unravel, and this is sort of the new problem of debating. But in that initial round, it was very well focused on the issue of the coronavirus pandemic, at obviously the mass unemployment play out of that pandemic, and on the role that the Trump administration as the governing force in the country played in either making that pandemic worse or, you know, responding to it. And each candidate had their opportunity to make their case. The challenge in this setting was that I was sort of amazed that Mike Pence came so very unprepared for the moment in which he found himself. And he basically ran a sort of line of argument that almost imagined people hadn't been paying attention for the last 6 months, and that somehow things had gone surprisingly well, and there but for China everything, why that sort of didn't work. Why I feel this for two reasons. Number one, we've just had such dramatic events in the last few days, the president himself getting ill, people all over the White House getting ill. As I mentioned before, the candidates on stage standing behind plexiglass screens, which are, you know, a physical representation of the concern about the spread of this virus. All of that, that's one side of it. And then the other side of it is that Kamala Harris approached her response to these questions in a very precise way. She had a case she wanted to make. She had clearly prepared a brief, and that brief was oriented toward a calendar. And if you watched it, it was sort of devastating as she went back to January 28th, some of the original briefings, and then brought in the Woodward revelations about the president trying to downplay the crisis, and then concluded with that devastating remark that they knew and they didn't tell you. They literally could have protected us, that this being her argument. They could have protected us, and they didn't do it. And the incredible thing about that is that Pence had no response for that. He wasn't, there may be a response, but he did not have it prepared. And at that point, I know, and I want to, I'm delighted to talk about the rest of the debate, but at that point, the debate was over. It was done, because on the critical issue of the moment, when you have a challenger saying to an incumbent figure, they failed you, they knew the truth and they lied to you, and the incumbent does not have a strong response to that, you know, something that is, you know, equally powerful or more powerful, you know, you can't claw your way back from that. And frankly, there's hard to try, and as capable a debater as Mike Pence is, it didn't happen.
Well, we are definitely going to learn more about COVID, because the filmmaker Alex Gibney and his very small team have spent the last 5 months, in their words, secretly interviewing scientists, doctors, and White House officials. A documentary called Totally Under Control, which are Trump's words, is coming out on Tuesday. And we're going to do a show about that new documentary on Tuesday. You know, I was really curious about Biden's COVID plan. Sadly, John and Dave, this is a low information election, given where we are with COVID, with Trump, just the political situation that we're dealing with right now. And so Biden's website has a number of initiatives that he's going to put into place. He says, first of all, he's going to call Dr. Fauci and say, I want you to lead our team. He says he's going to double the number of drive-through testing sites to ensure that there are no more lines. He's going to build a national contact tracing workforce, which we desperately need, implement a coordinated countrywide future-facing national effort to acquire, produce, and distribute PPE. They're going to also ensure that enough PPE is in place for future viruses. He wants to pay frontline workers, including nurses and doctors, more. He has actually said he wants to pay essential workers an additional $13 an hour. That's not getting much attention. What about this, Dave? I mean, these are major, major changes that would take place if Biden wins.
They are major changes. And the important thing to note about that is that not one of them could begin for at minimum 3.5 months. That's the time between now and the time that Joe Biden, were he to become president of the United States, would be inaugurated. So the big question right now on many Americans' mind is what's going to happen in the meantime? And there's so much that could happen. There's so much that could change. There's so much that could supersede some of the initiatives that Joe Biden wants to talk about. And probably chief among them would be whether there's going to be a workable vaccine that can be distributed. And we have no idea how the COVID numbers are going to go up or down, and in which states might have flare-ups and hotspots and other places that may get it under control. But the bottom line is what Joe Biden's trying to do is telegraph to the entire country that were he to become president, that no matter what the situation on the ground would be, that he would take about as dramatically different an approach to the coronavirus situation as Donald Trump and his administration has taken, that science would be the guiding light of the decisions that were being made, and that medical professionals and epidemiologists and the folks who are, you know, really at the forefront of trying to determine what to do, how to do it, and how to save lives and minimize damage, those would be the people who were driving the train, so to speak, not the President of the United States himself as a single individual. And I think you saw that during the debate when Kamala Harris made the remark, and I'm paraphrasing, that if Dr. Fauci or a medical professional said, hey, you should take this vaccine, she would take it. But if Donald Trump said that without medical backing, then she would not take it. So that was really, in a way, just a 10-second signal that really encapsulated the entire Biden plan for how they would approach the coronavirus as opposed to the way that it's being approached right now by the Trump administration.
John, what would you add? I've heard a few people, undecided voters, say, you know, I just don't know what they stand for. I don't know if there's a big difference. And that's why I think it's so important. I mean, we know that probably all of our listeners have already decided, but it's important to really talk about the changes that we would see if Biden wins.
Sure. There's a fundamental divide between these two parties. And when you have a campaign occurring at a time of national crisis, political parties always have a choice. They can adjust to respond to that crisis, or they can default to their traditional approaches. And in many senses, the Democratic Party has responded, not in all the ways I would like to see it do. I mean, I would love to see it do even more. But the party has clearly stepped up, and if you read the party platform, it's a huge document as regards COVID and the economic crisis that the country's in at this point. The Republican Party has been less coherent, but has essentially defaulted to its traditional view that the market should basically settle things, and a, you know, not a total market response. Obviously, there have been government interventions and steps, but one much more oriented toward that. Now, what's fascinating here is if you were putting this question to Trump, you would actually get a very different response from the one you get from Mike Pence. And we saw that at several points during the debate. Mike Pence doesn't like the government doing a lot of things, at least the government doing a lot of things for, you know, poor and working class people. You may be comfortable with it doing a lot for Wall Street or for corporate interests. But at key points, he was more interested in criticizing Kamala Harris and Joe Biden for, you know, whatever sympathies they may have for some form of national health care, for programs that you know, seek to create jobs, et cetera, and essentially activist government. So you have this clash there. And the challenge is that the moment we are in does demand, I think in the eyes of most folks, something more than what we've had. And so that does give the Democrats, gave Harris, especially last night, an advantage. And you saw a fascinating thing happen, that there were times when Pence would launch what in a traditional debate would have seemed like a really kind of brutal assault, where he would, you know, accuse Joe Biden or mention the issue of plagiarism, that he would take shots at Kamala Harris's record, hit on different things that the Democratic Party has done, may use the word socialist, et cetera, et cetera. And fascinatingly enough, Kamala Harris often didn't even respond. And in fact, if Susan Page asked another question, Kamala Harris, where you thought that Harris would, you know, kind of say, well, I'd like to answer that, but first I'm going to refer to what the vice president just said. You know, she just went right in and answered the question as Page asked it. And that was a very confident response in its own way, because it was Kamala Harris saying, what the vice president is saying is so absurd, so irrelevant to the moment that we are in, that I'm not even going to bother to argue with him, because at the end of the day, I just don't think anybody's going to look at how this administration has responded and feel it's sufficient. And so that was a confident response on Harris's part. But the last thing I'll say about it, and I do think it's important here, is that I do think Harris failed a little bit in this regard, because while I do think she prevailed in the debate, she should have spent more time explaining exactly what you're talking about, Rose, which is, you know, what's in the platform, which is this sort of programmatic stuff. In this sense, she was assuming people would sort of, you know, roll their eyes at Pence's claims about the successes of the current response, but there does need to be more of an explanation of what the next response might be.
Right, exactly. And then also talk to people who are really hurting right now, given mm-hmm. that Trump says there will be no relief, no talks yeah. until after the election. I mean, people are struggling to pay their rent, struggling to make ends meet. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll continue on this theme and talk more about relief and taxes and the economy. And then we'll discuss healthcare. Ooh. And the Supreme Court. I also was really surprised that Kamala Harris went so fast through Roe v. Wade. I mean, she really didn't spend much time talking about what is at stake. We had a show about this a couple weeks ago, and our guest said that abortion could be illegal in half of the states in this country if Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed. Today, we're joined by John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent at The Nation, and Dave Leventhal, Senior Washington Correspondent for Business Insider. We're talking about last night's first and only vice presidential debate with a focus on actual issues. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about last night's vice presidential debate. What stood out for you? What issues grabbed your attention? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're joined by John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent at The Nation and author of many books, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Dave Leventhal is Senior Washington Correspondent for Business Insider. Dave, I'm sure a lot of people who are really struggling right now, I mean, one in six people say that they do not have enough money to put enough food on the table, and it's just getting worse. A lot of people are getting evicted as we speak. People are wondering, if Biden wins, what is going to change for them? Because as you said, COVID is going up right now. We don't know what's going to happen, you know, in December, January, February. What else really stands out for you? We know that Biden backs a $15 federal minimum wage. He wants to end the tipped minimum wage. This is according to a tweet he put out in September. He is talking about making it easier for people to join unions. He wants to hold employers accountable for wage theft, union busting, and worker classification. But in the near term, for people who are really struggling right now, what changes can they expect?
It's largely going to depend, Rose, on not who is president of the United States, of course. A lot depends on that. But Congress is critical to this. Joe Biden may become president and he has a divided Congress, or Joe Biden becomes president and he has a Democratic Congress. You're looking at two very different scenarios, both you know, in the short term, meaning early next year, and long term, over the next several years, when you have a situation such as that. So any of the issues that you just brought up, in addition to probably 101 other ones, the balance of the U.S. Senate in particular is going to be critical. So we oftentimes, you know, focus 90% of our attention on the presidential race, and understandably so. That's the biggest race going. It's the national race. But the control of the Senate can't be understated. It's absolutely going to be critical to any of Joe Biden's platform agenda items ultimately coming into fruition and being reality if he becomes president. So I think that is probably the biggest linchpin that we have of all under a Biden administration, if he's going to go forward with that very, very detailed platform that he has up on his website.
And John, we're going to do a show about Senate races next week. So I'm sure that the Biden team is putting together a plan of what they would do if they have the House and the Senate. If they don't have the Senate, they're going to really have to focus on executive orders.
If they don't have the Senate, Joe Biden will be a lame duck president. I mean, it's silly to think that Joe Biden being elected in November would be able to govern in any kind of meaningful way as it relates to the agenda that Biden and others have laid out. The truth of the matter is that we would be reminded once again of the fundamental weakness of our political system, that you can be elected president, but if you don't have that Senate, you're essentially a prisoner of the Senate. Biden is someone who came out of that body, and so he has some connections there. He may be able to go over and talk to Mitch McConnell about some policies, and they might even sort things out on a couple of issues. But at the end of the day, it will be McConnell who will set the parameters. He will define the limits of what a Biden presidency would mean. And so the Senate races in many ways become more important than the presidential race. And it's not that the presidential race isn't huge, and Donald Trump has been a very disruptive president, and people can see all the great challenges, and many people have great fears about what would happen in a second Trump term. But the bottom line reality is that as the process is currently constructed, if Trump were to have a Democratic Senate, he would be profoundly constrained and have to respond to that. And if Biden has a Republican Senate, he would be profoundly constrained. That's just the reality. And so to my mind, this is where we're getting into the interesting kind of calculus of the 2020 campaign, because Biden has, according to the polls, opened up a relatively solid lead nationally and a pretty good lead in a number of the battleground states. Biden and the Democrats have to build that out. They cannot be, you know, satisfied with just the notion that they may beat Donald Trump. And again, that the possibility that the polls are correct. They have to look for those openings in the Senate races that give them not just a tie in the Senate where Harris would break the ties, but a two or three seat majority that would temper some of the
challenges they have within their own party of uniting around issues. And if they have that, if you have a President Biden, Vice President Harris, and a Democratic Senate, you know, in roughly a 52-48 split, 53-47, then you start to get to the point where campaign promises might actually be kept. But anything short of that, the reality is that at best we will have a slight softening of our current circumstance, but not we will not have a pivot toward any of the profound and necessary responses that people are hoping for.
And I've been surprised that, you know, Biden and Harris, why aren't they spending more time saying, you know, here are our top three or five agenda items, but in order to get these done, we need to have a Democratic Senate and House. John, why aren't they talking more about this?
Because they're inept politically. They are not good at what they do. And it isn't necessarily their fault. It's not a criticism of Joe Biden personally or of Kamala Harris. It is a recognition of the fact that the Democratic Party long ago lost its coherence as a party. They became very oriented toward the individual they're running for president and a hyper-focus on the top of the ticket and very little focus on the kind of up and down coherence. The reason for that is because the party is deeply divided. And this is something that Democrats don't like to talk about very much, but it's what I write about in my book. There is a true fight for the soul of the Democratic Party that plays out in every election. You have a left within the party, and then you have a center-right grouping within the party. They don't like each other. They fight with each other. They do not cooperate with each other. They undermine. And as a result, there tends to be this, you know, you focus up the ticket. You try to make everybody love the people at the top of the ticket. You forget about the rest of it. This has played out since the 1940s, and it continues to play out. And frankly, it's a very, for Democrats, a very, very dangerous reality. There are a couple times in history, in relatively recent history, where Democrats got it together and had a coherent message. And one of the great lost ones was not in a presidential race, but in 1982, when Tip O'Neill and Teddy Kennedy, two Massachusetts Democrats, relatively old school, came up in the midst of a recession moment with a very simple program of a jobs program and, you know, essentially a bit of activist government. And they laid it out and they kept banging away on it. And they had huge gains. It was a very, very successful race because they all talked about the same thing. And if the Democrats were all talking about the same thing, i.e. an activist agenda to respond to a pandemic, mass unemployment, a cry for racial justice, and a climate crisis that is overwhelming, if they really did that in a coherent way and kind of got on message, they I think would have the possibility of a realigning election. A failure to do that, and so far they have failed to do that.
Well, the Kentucky Senate race, I think, is a great example of this. And you wrote about this, John. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mitch McConnell was running in a primary against the progressive Charles Booker.
Amy McGrath was.
Right. But they would take on Mitch McConnell, right? So in the primary, you had Amy McGrath, the moderate, running against Charles Booker, the progressive, and that winner would take on Mitch McConnell. And the Chuck Schumers of the world and the establishment Dems got behind the moderate Amy McGrath. You wrote about this. And I think this really speaks to what you're saying.
No, it was a nightmare scenario because, you had Amy McGrath, who was literally, not putting much distance between herself and Donald Trump, and running this sort of bizarre campaign and getting a lot of support from the National Democrats. Then you had Charles Booker came out with initially very limited resources, went across the state and basically electrified folks with a message, his message, from the hood to the holler, i.e. uniting urban voters and rural voters around a sort of an economic and social justice message. Now, I'm not saying that Booker would necessarily have won. I mean, it's a tough state. There's no doubt of that. But what has played out with Amy McGrath as the nominee has caused consternation, you know, outside of Kentucky, because Amy McGrath is actually running ads in Cincinnati area media market, which goes into southern Ohio, with people talking about, you know, that they're going to vote for Donald Trump and for Amy McGrath. That message undermines the Democratic message in Ohio, where they're actually trying to win the state for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And so this is the kind of deep incoherence of the Democratic Party at this point. And it is not, it's not something that functions well politically.
John Nichols is national affairs correspondent with The Nation. Dave Leventhal is senior Washington correspondent for Business Insider. We're talking about last night's vice presidential debate. And, you know, as John said, Joe Biden, of course, John and others would like Joe Biden to have more Bernie Sanders-like positions, but his positions are very, very different, obviously, from Trump. But in order to get these things passed, he needs the Senate and the House. And for some reason, they're just not spending much time talking about that. So what are your thoughts about last night's debate? Overall thoughts about what we're discussing today? 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Ruthann and El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I wanted to go off topic a bit and talk about form as opposed to content. I was really very, very, very disappointed in the moderator. I think she did a horrible job. In fact, if she was moderating a junior high school debate, it would have been even more embarrassing. I mean, she did not have the stamina to enforce the rules. And as much as Trump was his usual bombastic self in flagrantly disobeying everything when he did his debate, Mike Pence was more subtle, but he still trampled all over her and refused to shut up when it was his time to shut up.
Well, thank you for that, Ruthann. I think one of my main criticisms is that both candidates did not answer certain questions, and I wish Susan Page had said, for example, here's one good question to Mike Pence. If Roe v. Wade is overturned, what would you want Indiana to do? Would you want your state to ban all abortions? He did not answer the question. And she didn't ask him again, which I wish she would have, Dave, because a lot is at stake if Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed to the Supreme Court. If Roe is pushed back, if abortion is pushed back to the states, it could be illegal in half of the states in this country.
So I will say one blanket thing about moderating debates, having myself moderated a few at the congressional and gubernatorial level before. It is hard, and you can come in as prepared as you possibly can be, and these things are organic. They have a way of going in, spiraling in their own directions. You have a limited amount of time. You're racing against the clock. The candidates are always going to try to steal, you know, an extra 30 seconds or a minute, and you want to keep on schedule while at the same time, too, following up on questions. That all being said, absolutely, that I think was a profound moment where a very pointed question about banning all abortions in Indiana was brought up. Mike Pence, he immediately started talking about Iran, and then he kind of turned back and talked about Amy Coney Barrett and the Supreme Court and never really answered the question. I guess on the Kamala Harris side, it was kind of a dramatic moment when she never answered the direct question of, hey, will you go beyond or advocate for going beyond 9 Supreme Court justices to something else? And it would have been great for the public to hear something like, well, hey, I can't do that as president or vice president. That's going to be up to Congress, or I support this or I don't. But Kamala Harris talked about packing the court with Trump people, which is how she interpreted that question, too. So there were a few moments where both candidates, but especially Mike Pence, just simply didn't answer the question. And yeah, it's not the easiest thing to do. But at the same time, I do sense that a lot of people who watched the debate were scratching their heads a little bit, saying, man, I really wish I would have gotten an answer to fill in the blank question, and I just didn't.
And I want to stick with Roe for a minute because it is so incredibly important. John, I was really surprised that Kamala Harris didn't spend more time talking about what will happen if abortion goes back to the states. She said, "I will always fight for a woman's right to make a decision about her own body." And then she pivoted to the Affordable Care Act. I mean, we're in the year 2020, and we're talking about the possibility of women and girls having to fly to other states to have an abortion. And the guest we had on a couple of weeks ago said, well, if that's legal, she said, in some very conservative states, they might make it illegal to actually go to other states to have this procedure. You know, the other questions here, and it's shocking to even be asking this, what's the consequence? Jailing doctors? Jailing women and girls? I mean, we have to really ask these questions right now.
Of course we have to, and it's notable that when Donald Trump was asked about this back in the last campaign in 2016, he gave some exceptionally troubling answers about, you know, how you would respond to doctors and the women involved. And so, there's a set of profound issues, and this is a place where, while I've been quite complimentary of Kamala Harris's actions in this debate, how she handled it, I thought there were some concerning moments. And they generally involve playing out the scenarios that might result if Amy Coney Barrett goes on the Supreme Court. And frankly, if the Democrats don't expand the court, don't add justices, should they come to power. And that is the prospect that you see the Affordable Care Act upended and you see Roe upended. And frankly, labor law protections and a host of other protections. There is an awful lot at stake. And you're right to focus on Roe because it goes to so many deep human concerns in literally the lives of women in states across this country. And so, yes, I would argue that there needed to be a much deeper and longer discussion of the consequences of what could happen with the transition to court. But you see, that goes to something that Dave was just talking about, and that was the failure to give a clear answer to the question about whether you would expand the court. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats clearly, I mean, it's now in two debates, they clearly don't want to get locked into a position on that. And as a result, that sort of backs them up on all of these issues. They don't really want to go into a deep, detailed discussion about the consequences of the Coney Barrett nomination, because if they do, then they have to talk about what they would do to respond to it. And so you see politicians you see the wheels turning in the head, and they're like, well, I'm going to give a more cautious answer here. I'm going to get off of these issues. I'm going to go to other issues, because I don't really want to get boxed in on, you know, talking about what would have to be done. And,
right.
And this is just pure politics. There's no question of that. But it's a very troubling politics at this point, because it does suggest, well, let me put it another way, just the quickest, easiest way. Politicians are rarely better once they're elected than they are during the campaign. And so if they won't say what they're going to do on the campaign trail, there's a pretty good chance they won't do it when they're in power. And that's an unsettling prospect, because that means that you could indeed see the ACA and Roe fall in this court, and the Democrats not have a coherent plan for what to do.
Well, and then to take it a step further, let's say Biden, the Democrats get the Senate and the House, and let's say Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed. If the Democrats pass solid legislation, for example, on the climate crisis, it could go all the way to the Supreme Court and be overturned.
Mm-hmm. No, there's simply no question of that. And again, I'd go to a core issue that relates to so many of these other issues as well that doesn't get discussed enough. Samuel Alito's made it extremely clear that it is his mission on this court to essentially destroy the U.S. labor movement. To undermine trade unions in this country. That's not a debatable point. It's clearly his mission. And he's getting close to a majority in favor of taking actions that would make it exceptionally hard to organize unions and collectively bargain at a point when such actions may be more necessary than ever. or you know, unions maybe more necessary as ever than ever. And so we're in a situation where there are profound issues as regards the court and play, and it's why I happen to think we have too few debates, not enough of them. I genuinely believe there should be a presidential and maybe even another vice presidential debate about COVID and all the issues related to it. But there should also be a full debate about the court and about all the issues that the court deals with and how to handle it. And just sliding it in is kind of one question along the way is not the way to have a deep, meaningful discussion about something that's in play right now and could fundamentally alter America.
What would you add, Dave?
And I'm sorry, you cut out for just a second, Rose.
Well, actually, let me just ask you another question, just briefly, because we're almost out of time. I really was hoping to get more substance on the climate crisis. It seems like, you know, the Republicans are throwing out this socialist stuff and the Green New Deal is this horrific socialist plan. And it's like the Democrats don't know what to do with that. They can't really, it's almost like they're having a hard time defending their climate policy. I mean, we know that, you know, we can call Biden's plan kind of Green New Deal light, but I was really wanting more substance when it comes to what they would do on the climate crisis.
Yeah, and if you support the Green New Deal, you were pretty PO'd, I think, last night with the answers that Kamala Harris gave, particularly since she has been supportive, in theory, of the Green New Deal. Now, is the Green New Deal going to pass in its current form without amendment? No, I don't think under any circumstance, regardless of whether the Democrats win the House and the Senate or not. But at the same time, too, the Biden plan is lacking in the eyes of many on the left side of the Democratic Party right now. And Joe Biden and Kamala Harris don't quite have an answer that is at all satisfying to people who believe that that climate change and the issues writ large of environmental justice are right up there with any other issue. And our issues that are existential in nature, that unless we get this right, unless we solve it, then we're going to be in some pretty big trouble. So that's going to be something that you better expect. There's going to be a lot of pressure on a Biden administration if Joe Biden becomes president, not from the outside, not from the Republicans, but the internal machinations of the party. And that really speaks to kind of what we talked about a little earlier, which is that the Democratic Party has a lot of pressures in it, and there's a lot of internal turmoil that is manifesting itself in political ways, but also too could potentially manifest itself in some significant policy ways, the environment being chief among them.
Just quickly, what would you add on this, John? It seems like the Democrats are always on the defense here. Kamala Harris, you know, said Joe Biden will not end fracking. He's been very clear about that. Okay, but what is the plan?
It's a terrible and unnecessary answer, by the way. Joe Biden will not end fracking. Even if that's the case, it was irrelevant to this debate. And frankly, the passion that went into saying repeatedly that Joe Biden won't end fracking was wasted energy that actually frustrates a lot of people who think it is time to end fracking. And so the fear that the Democratic Party has of going deep into a response to the climate crisis, and frankly, the fear that its candidates have of being called socialists because they actually want to use government in the way that Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman and others did, is omnipresent. It does define how they go into these debates, and it's problematic because if you really want to build out the big majority that Democrats, I think, need to win the Senate and things like that, they ought to be talking to especially younger voters and trying to draw them into the process. And if you look at the polling, young voters are very enthusiastic about a big, bold response to the climate crisis. And again, I think in both the presidential debate and the vice presidential debate, you saw some very poor signaling and very cautious signaling in that regard. Mm.
And Dave, a final question. We have a couple people emailing, say, Alicia, for example, I was shocked and scared that Pence refused to say what he will do if Trump refuses to step down. I wish the moderator or Harris had pressed him more on this. It is critical to our democracy. What would you say to that, Dave? Susan Page said, if Biden is declared the winner and Trump refuses to accept a peaceful transfer of power, what would be your role? And he didn't answer.
And I'm not surprised at all. Either he may legitimately have no answer at this moment in time because, well, what would Donald Trump be doing? Would he be chaining himself to the Oval Office? Would he be trying to marshal armed forces to defend him? I mean, and there are all different sorts of scenarios where that could play out, and the role that Mike Pence would play or not play in that kind of scenario were it to pass. And I do think that most people think that is a relatively unlikely scenario, but who knows with Donald Trump? And Mike Pence may not have any more insight than any of us when it comes to what Donald Trump would do in that situation, just knowing how completely impulsive Donald Trump can be. I mean, many of the things that we saw in the past week with Donald Trump having COVID and coming out of the hospital and having these impromptu videos cut and availabilities, he wasn't consulting Mike Pence for any of this, so far as anyone is reported or known. So as a result, that could be difficult. Now, he could have very well said, well, I will make sure that our democratic process goes forward in an orderly fashion and that we stay true to the Constitution and provide some reassuring words, but that would have been effectively cutting against everything that Donald Trump has said about the election over the past many months. Mike Pence is not there to contradict the president. He's not there to say something that's going to be opposite of what Donald Trump says. So given the choice between saying something that's going to contradict Donald Trump and saying nothing at all, Mike Pence is going to choose the latter about 10 out of 10 times.
Dave Leventhal is senior Washington correspondent for Business Insider, where he covers politics, policy, and power in D.C. Dave, thanks so much again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Rose.
John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of many bestsellers, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. It is a great book. You can find our conversation with John about that book on Your Call. It's about a couple of months ago now. Thank you, as always, John. Thanks for joining us.
It's an honor to be on with you and with Dave. Thanks so much
for having
me.
And thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. You can find past shows at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.